Experts claim there is nothing tougher than a diamond. But at Diamonds Direct, we beg to differ. Have you ever met a mother? Strong, radiant, timeless. This Mother's Day, give her the gift that meets her match. With diamond jewelry starting at $200, plus Diamonds Direct's exceptional quality and unbeatable everyday price, you're sure to give her a gift that wows this generation and the next to come. Experience the thrill of jewelry shopping done right at Diamonds Direct. Diamonds Direct. Your love, our passion.
When you have insurance, it's easy to forget about your out-of-pocket costs. That can be a lot of money. How do you know you're not overpaying? HealthLock can help. HealthLock is a technology company that securely connects with your insurance and reviews your claims for overbilling, wrong codes, and even fraud. To date, HealthLock has saved its members over $130 million. To save, visit healthlock.com. Do it today before you see another healthcare provider.
You don't just live in your home, you live in your neighborhood as well. So when you're shopping for a home, you want to know as much about the area around it as possible. Luckily, Homes.com has got you covered. Each listing features a comprehensive neighborhood guide from local experts. Everything you'd ever want to know about a neighborhood, including the number of homes for sale, transportation, local amenities, cultural attractions, unique qualities, and even things like median lot size and a noise score. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Hi, I'm Molly Jongfast, and this is Fast Politics, where we discuss the top political headlines with some of today's best minds. We're on vacation, but that doesn't mean we don't have an amazing show for you today. Professor Lawrence Lessig and Matthew Seligman stop by to talk their new book, How to Steal a Presidential Election. But first, we have the author of the new handbook for a post-Roe America, an executive director of the West Alabama Women's Center, Robin Marty. Welcome back to Fast Politics, Robin Marty.
Thank you so much for having me back. It's always so much fun.
I want to talk to you whenever I am thinking about how women have lost a right they had for 50 years, and we were told it was not a big deal. So you're in Alabama. You used to have an abortion clinic. You now have an STD clinic, right?
I'm just going to say right now, I have the most amazing clinic, and I'm so excited about it. I'm actually really excited about 2024, and I don't know when this is going to run exactly. So I'm going to tell you a secret, which is that we just hired a doula.
Yes.
We already do prenatal care. We do STI testing and treatment. We do annual exams. We do contraception. All of our stuff is free and sliding scale. One of the things that has really frustrated us about the work that we do is that there's only one hospital in Tuscaloosa. And honestly, there's only two hospitals in Western Alabama in general. And our doctor is not allowed to deliver at our hospital because she used to do abortions.
Say that one more time.
Yeah. Our doctor is not allowed to deliver at the hospital.
Deliver babies.
Yes. I don't know if they think she's just like suddenly going to in the middle of it go, oh, oops, what do I do with this one or what?
I'm here to kill everyone.
They have literally told us that there's no point in her applying for a transfer agreement or delivering agreement or anything like that because they're not going to grant it. And they suggested that we maybe use a hospital that's like almost an hour away, which these are patients who are low income, often uninsured right, or on Medicaid. It is difficult for them to travel, and often they have complications. We want them to be able to use the hospital that is in their city. But so right, we can't deliver, and none of the doctors will work with us. They have all said no. So what happens is we provide prenatal care for a patient, and we do this because we let people in immediately. We verify their pregnancy, which is what they need to do in order to get onto insurance or Medicaid. We see these patients until the point that they get their insurance, and we see them for free. And then at the point that they get insured, they can start to look for another doctor because no doctor will see them until they have insurance. But doctors don't want to see Medicaid patients. They don't want to see uninsured patients. Right. So we can't get these patients in anywhere. So often we're finding that our patients can't get doctors, will go into the hospital in what is known as an unattached patient. And so what that means is they show up, they can't pre-register for the hospital. They can't do anything like if they need non-stress tests, which is something that you do once a week if you are diabetic.
And a lot of these women may be diabetic, right?
Yeah. We can't order a labor induction if somebody is super past due and we think that it's time for that. We can't do any of these things. All we can do is after every appointment, we give the patient her paperwork so that she can take that file with her. And then she is allowed to show up in the hospital when she's in labor. And one of the things that we're really terrified by is they're going in there with no ally, nobody to help make sure the doctor is listening to them. And we don't know how the doctors treat them because we know how the doctor is treating our staff and saying that we are no good.
Right. Not great.
We don't know if this transfers over to the patients. And we also know that this hospital is not kind to Black women. And almost all of our patients are Black. So now we have been able to hire a doula onto staff, which is such a huge blessing and something that I've been trying to do, trying to get the money together for over a year now. And we finally were able to get it. She'll be starting next year and we will be able to offer a doula to every patient who stays with us. And she will be able to accompany them into the hospital.
When I'm listening to you, I'm hearing the incredible racism that these women face. And you'll remember that maternal fetal mortality is, I think, many multitudes higher for Black women than it is for white women.
Not only is it many multitudes higher, right now in Alabama, which is in Alabama, every one in 100 Black women is likely to die in birth. That's how bad it is. The highest in the nation.
If you're a Black woman, you go into the hospital with a 1% chance of dying in childbirth in the year 2023.
Yes, exactly. And we just had the latest statistics for infant mortality. And in Alabama, infant mortality actually did decrease this year, which is unlike any of the other states. However, it decreased for white babies and it decreased a lot for white babies, but it still increased for Black babies.
Wait, say that one more time.
If you were having a white baby, that baby is less likely to die this year than it was last year. However, if you are having a Black baby, that baby is more likely to die than last year. And so our state was praising the fact that our infant mortality rate went down, but it was entirely just for the white population.
There's so many levels of injustice here. I just can't even break it down. This is what the Republicans want. These are people having babies. These are people not having abortions because they can't get abortions. Talk to me about what it is like. I mean, so you have a baby, you are more likely to die. I mean, it's just incredible. But they're forcing you to have the babies because it's all about life, right?
Well, and it's more than forcing someone to have a baby. They are forcing people to become pregnant, in my opinion. There has been no push in any way, shape, or form, no financial incentive, no nothing to make sure that contraception is getting to people who do not have the ability to pay for it. It is just not there. Here we are with no legal abortion, with the rising maternal mortality issues, and you still cannot access contraception in the state of Alabama if you don't have insurance or if you are on Medicaid, unless you go to a county health department. These are people who do not have primary care physicians, so they cannot get it that way. There is one Planned Parenthood clinic left in the entire state. The others have closed. And so there's Planned Parenthood and there's us. And we are the places where a person can go to be able to get this free or no cost birth control. And so when you are not allowing people to be able to access contraception, one of the reasons being, of course, that Medicaid has not been expanded yet, but there are a myriad of other ways that they could make this accessible. They could provide grants to different cities. They could tap individual doctors and ask them to do it. There are all these ways that they could expand Title X, but instead, our state still has the rule that says Title X funding, the millions of dollars that we get from the federal government, can only be dispersed via a county health department, even though the county health departments are understaffed, often closed, and so the wait is many months.
Jesus. I'm not
surprised because every time I talk to you, why I love to talk to you, besides the fact that you're smart and you're right and you're a good person and you're just doing the real work on the ground. One of the reasons why I love talk to you is because you are really seeing what's happening in Alabama in a way that people in government or even who are in media are not necessarily seeing it. So I'm hoping you could talk to me about, are people still getting abortions in Alabama? I mean, what does it look like? What's happening?
I'm not sure. We know that there's already been an uptick in pregnancies and childbirths in that 6 month period that was in 2022. We did see that number go up. That has been qualified in statistics. So definitely there are less people getting abortions. We know that much. We are not, I will say, we are seeing less people coming in asking about abortion, which in some ways is really good because we can't say anything still because of this horrible lawsuit that we're running against the attorney general. The attorney general says that if we provide them with any information about an abortion, even if it's a legal abortion in a legal state, we could be held as part of a criminal conspiracy. So that's something that we're still waiting to go through the courts. It was supposed to have a hearing end of October, and it got postponed, and we haven't heard anything since. So at this point, basically, me, my staff, we're still gagged from providing any literally like public information. But people are not coming in as much. I will say that in Tuscaloosa, we are seeing a definite uptick in the number of pregnant patients that we're seeing. We used to see maybe 3 or 4 new pregnancies come in a week. Now we're seeing probably at least 15 people who come in for pregnancy verification and paperwork. And of them, like probably half of them stay with us at least for a few months to get their prenatal care. So it's definitely difficult for people to go get abortions. I don't think as many people are trying to get abortions. Our abortion fund is still not able to provide any sort of funding for abortions. But also, this is a community that has lacked healthcare, that is preventative healthcare. They lack basic quality issues, safe housing, good food, all of the things that a person needs in order to be healthy. And because of that, I do not know what the rates of miscarriage is. And what is induced miscarriage, or whether that is just people having miscarriages because that's what happens when you have unhealthy bodies and they're made pregnant. I do think that that is increasing. I don't have numbers that I can point to yet that show that, but we are not seeing healthy patients. I will put it that way. And we are likely seeing patients. I can say that we are seeing patients that we've already seen who were pregnant before, who are not pregnant now, who are pregnant again. And so they don't always tell us that they had a miscarriage or if they went and had an abortion. But I will say that the amount of people giving birth is going up, but that it's not as much as I think it should be.
Right. So it might be people taking medication abortion.
Yeah, it might be. But it also might just be people who are having miscarriages, which honestly, that worries me because miscarriages are, I don't know a better way to say it, they're expensive because if you go to a hospital, that is a huge hospital bill, especially for people who are uninsured. Miscarriages that have a lot of potential danger to them if they aren't followed up on. Honestly, I'm just really extremely worried about our community in general.
So we have two women in the news right now, Kate Cox and Brittany Watts. And I feel like these cases are, in my mind, irrevocably linked because they are two women who... So I want to talk first to you about Kate Cox.
Yes.
The most attractive white person you've ever seen in your life.
Yeah.
She's the world's greatest plaintiff, right?
She's the poster child of the justified abortion. Yes, for sure.
Exactly. She's got two kids. She wants to have more kids. She's had sections. She's worried about it. I mean, it just is like, it's not a baby. It's 21 weeks. It has a 0.0 chance of surviving. If it survives, it dies in her arms. Okay. So when they were lying about the abortion exception, this was the lie that they were shopping, right? It was a lie, and she exposed that. Why do you think, my question about Kate Cox is more like, why aren't we seeing more plaintiffs like this?
Because the type of people who are likely to have wanted pregnancies that go wrong are the type of people who have the most resources to leave, and they're not put themselves through this. The reality is that when it comes to abortion, while not dangerous, it is always safer the earlier you do it. And also, nobody wants to be pregnant with when they don't want to be. Like, nobody wants to carry around a child that they know is never going to result in a live birth if they are pregnant and wanted to be pregnant. I know personally, when I had a miscarriage during my second pregnancy, the moment I found out that there was a non-viable fetus inside of me, all I could think every moment was get it out, get it out, get it out, get it out. How fast could I do it? How quickly could I get it done? I could not imagine going through what Kate Cox went through in order to try to get permission and to do this lawsuit in order to stay home. Honestly, she's a hero just for that.
Yeah, she really is a hero just for that. And she's put herself through hell.
And I mean, honestly, the idea of a court coming back and saying, I'm sorry, but your life is not worth it. There is no justifiable reason for you to have an abortion. If you die, so be it. That's a risk that you run for being pregnant, because that's what they think. The other side of this is just, I don't know how much inherent belief. I used to track all the time as a reporter the idea that they were leaving exceptions. Like, the original Texas 20-week ban had no exceptions. They leave out fetal anatomy and they say it's because doctors can be wrong. And so what do we do with politicians and a legal system that do not believe in medicine? Honestly, if people ever get outraged, and God, I hope like regular people finally get outraged at some point about what anti-abortion activism has done to this nation, it is about how it has utterly destroyed doctor-patient relationships in every sort of form. People can't trust doctors anymore because politicians say that they don't actually know things, or that God can step in and make a miracle. Our patients can't trust us because we can't necessarily give them all of the information that they should be allowed to have about their pregnancy and their choices. We can't trust our patients because we don't know if they are actually seeking an abortion or are trying to gather evidence against us for a lawsuit. Like, the way that they have destroyed any ability for medicine to be practiced in a open and helpful and patient-centered way is just horrifying.
Jesus. So, okay, so Kate Cox, we talked about that. Brittany Watts.
That is an example of how any person can be accused of an abortion. And that is what we told people would happen. We told people it doesn't matter if they write these laws that say, oh, but the person who is having an abortion is exempt.
Let me just explain Brittany Watts. Black woman in Ohio has miscarriage. She knows something is wrong. She goes to the hospital twice. Two times the doctors send her home and tell her she's okay. She has a miscarriage, 21 weeks in the toilet. It's not a baby. Flushes the whatever, that fetal tissue, blood, down the toilet. It gets stuck. She plunges the toilet. She's now being charged with corpse mango, some kind of weird...
Defecation of a corpse.
Yes, defecation of a corpse. The medical examiner said the fetus was dead before it was expelled. She is, a jury is deciding whether or not she should stand trial.
She is every patient, in all honesty. Like, if I had a dollar for every patient that has told us that they went to the hospital because they thought they were miscarrying and had been sent home, our clinic would be funded. That is what happens. We've already seen, like, the New York Times article that came out Tuesday about how doctors with their inherent racial bias will often ignore what a patient is telling them when something is wrong, when it's a Black woman. That is what happens. I was thinking a lot yesterday about the idea that we know that, especially out here, doctors are primarily white, OBGYNs even, primarily white, primarily male, and the patriarchal and racism that goes with being an OBGYN in the South. And I started thinking a lot about, we talk about all the different things that could impact that, about how abortion bans are driving people away from wanting to practice down here, about how abortion bans are ending training so that people are able to get the training that they need to be able to provide abortions or miscarriage management. But one of the things that I never really thought about that really popped into my head yesterday was the idea of how our lack of sexual education is laying a foundation that is going to make it so that nobody wants to practice gynecology down here, because we don't talk about sex. We don't talk about body parts. Nobody thinks about, oh, hey, this is something that I might want to go into at some point, because sex is this taboo, nasty thing out here that nobody in polite society would even discuss. How is that impacting a child who is going up through elementary school, who's going into high school? How is this impacting people who might decide to go to medical school? Because this is not something then that everybody is going to think is accessible and acceptable and something that they should do. And so I think that we are looking at essentially a multiple generational loss of having providers, and especially providers who are in communities and know communities and are of the people that they will be serving and treating.
Yeah, that's right. Jesus. Thank you so much, Robin. I hope you'll come back.
Anytime. I hate to say it's fun, but I love being on here. I really knew what's going on down here.
AI might be the most important new computer technology ever. It's storming every industry, and literally billions of dollars are being invested. So buckle up. The problem is that AI needs a lot of speed and processing power. So how do you compete without costs spiraling out of control? It's time to upgrade to the next generation of the cloud. Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is a single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. OCI has 4 to 8 times the bandwidth of other clouds, offers one consistent price instead of variable regional pricing, and of course, nobody does data better than Oracle. So now you can train your AI models at twice the speed and less than half the cost of other clouds. If you want to do more and spend less like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic, take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/strategic. That's oracle.com/strategic. Oracle.com/strategic.
When you have health insurance, it's easy to think, I'm covered, no worries, right? Well, not so fast. What about your out-of-pocket costs? That can be a lot of money for you and your family. And if you're like me, you can't help but wonder, was I overbilled? You're not alone. It's estimated that over 50% of medical bills contain errors. Unless you're a billing expert, how do you know your medical bills are accurate? That's why I want to tell you about HealthLock. What is HealthLock? It's a healthcare technology company that securely connects with your family's insurance. When your medical claims come in, HealthLock technology reviews the claims for errors like overbilling, wrong codes, and even fraud. HealthLock makes it easy to find and fix hidden errors, so you pay only what you owe. To date, HealthLock has saved its members over $130 million. Bottom line, insurance alone isn't enough. HealthLock finds medical bill errors before you pay. To save, visit healthlock.com. Do it today before you see another healthcare provider.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
This is it, your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Lawrence Lessig is a professor at Harvard University, and Matthew Seligman is a fellow at the Constitutional Law Center at Stanford University. They are both authors of How to Steal a Presidential Election, which is available for pre-order now. Welcome, Matthew.
Hi, nice to be here.
And welcome, Larry.
Great to be here.
So the book is How to Steal an Election. First, we're going to talk about these faithless electors. So talk to me about what that is and what it means in the process of stealing elections.
Yeah, so since the beginning of the Republic, there have been electors who've been chosen and then decided to vote in a way contrary to how people expect it. The very first one of these was in 1796 with a guy named Sam Miles, who was chosen to support Adams in Pennsylvania. But when the votes came in, it seemed like Jefferson actually had won Pennsylvania. So he decided to vote for Jefferson. And that infuriated people because he was selected for the purpose of voting for Adams, and he changed his vote and voted for Jefferson. Nonetheless, when the 12th Amendment came along, which was the only major amendment of the Electoral College process, they didn't change that process, giving electors their freedom to vote as they wanted. So throughout history, you've had electors deciding to vote contrary to how they were pledged. In 2016, this became quite a serious issue because a bunch of electors, after seeing that Donald Trump had not won the popular vote, even though he had won the Electoral College vote, decided to get together and try to persuade enough Republican electors to vote for somebody other than Donald Trump so it could go to the House of Representatives and the House could decide to vote however they wanted. They could vote for Donald Trump. They could vote for another Republican. They could, in principle, have voted for Hillary Clinton, but that obviously was not going to happen. So they tried to rally people. They failed to rally enough Republicans. They rallied a couple. And then after the election, a couple of them were fined. And I actually took the case to the Supreme Court to decide whether this tradition that had existed since the founding of electors being allowed to exercise their judgment was actually constitutionally protected or whether states could overturn it. That was pretty clear it was constitutionally protected, but 9-0, the court went the other way.
So that's so interesting to me because I thought it was constitutionally protected.
Yeah, so did I. In 2020, I guess it was July of 2020, the Supreme Court decided 9-0 that in fact states could control how electors could vote. So this creates two real problems in the upcoming election. One problem it creates is just that not all states actually control how the electors can vote. So there's a bunch of states still where the electors are free to vote however they want. And so in principle, you could imagine candidates persuading electors to switch their vote. It's never happened for an illegitimate reason in the history of the Republic. You know, there's been legitimate reasons you could agree or disagree with them. But that's still an open question right now. But the second more dangerous issue, which the Supreme Court case created, is that you could imagine a legislature after an election deciding it didn't like the results of the election or didn't have confidence in the results of the election. What they can't do at that point is pick a new slate of electors. But what they can do, we argue, under the reasoning of the Supreme Court case, is basically tell their electors how they must vote. So the electors could have been elected to vote for Joe Biden. And then the legislature passes a law that says, we actually think the real winner in our state was Donald Trump. So we direct you to vote for Donald Trump. And the Supreme Court upheld the procedure that said that if they don't vote the way they've been directed, they can be removed and replaced with somebody who will. So this is a huge hole in the electoral system that's been created. And there's no obvious way to fill it unless the Supreme Court finds a way to reach out and clarify or restrict the scope of their decision.
So this is different than what happened with Trump and his slates of fake electors. Can you talk a little bit about that?
In the lead up into the 2020 election, Trump obviously was fighting in every single court he could to get the results in key swing states reversed. And it's just an unfortunate feature of our Electoral College system that the electors have to vote on a particular day, and that day might actually be before the results in a state are decided. So in 1960 in Hawaii, the election seemed to go for Richard Nixon. Then there was a recount ordered, and that recount and certification didn't occur or didn't complete until after the electors had to vote. So what the Democratic electors did, as well as the Republican electors, is they both met on the day electors were supposed to vote and cast their ballots, the Democrats for Kennedy, the Republicans for Nixon. And then when the election was finally resolved, the slate of electors for Kennedy was urgently sent to the Capitol. The Nixon ones had already been sent. And Nixon was the vice president. And Nixon said, well, it's kind of an odd situation, but not setting any precedent, I'm going to recommend we count the votes for Kennedy. And Kennedy's votes were counted. The Trump electors and the lawyers for Trump, Ken Chesbrough most directly.
Everyone's favorite.
So they knew of this precedent. Chesbrough was urgently writing memos to states around the country saying that if you want your electoral votes to count, they've got to be cast on Elector Day. Now, in some states, that was completely bogus, like New Mexico. The Trump campaign filed a lawsuit 15 minutes before the electors were supposed to vote to somehow create cover for Republican electors to vote, even though the state had been decided by more than 10 points for Biden. In other states, it was more open. The state of Wisconsin had an ongoing state court proceeding, which was resolved only 15 minutes before the electors were supposed to vote. At least a vote of the state Supreme Court was resolved then, but they still hadn't filed their motion for rehearing. So plausibly, they had an ongoing chance that their votes would count. So they also met and cast their ballots. Now, all of these electors are called fake electors. I think I believe, and I think Matt agrees with me, that it's not fair to call all of them fake electors. If you genuinely believe the election is undecided, the only way your votes could ever count is if you gather and vote on Elector Day. It's just a flawed system. So if they genuinely, in good faith, believed it was an unresolved election, then it's a good thing they gather and vote. Because if they didn't, their votes couldn't count. This is one of the lessons that Ken Chesbrough learned because he worked for Al Gore in 2000. And the lawyers for Al Gore made the incredibly stupid mistake of conceding that everything had to be resolved by what's called the Safe Harbor Day, which was days before the electors were supposed to vote. So the Gore electors actually never voted on Electors Day. They never cast their ballots. So even if somehow, you know, the whole system had inverted and the recount had happened and Gore had won, there wouldn't have been any electoral votes to be counted on January 6th. So that's why Ken Chesbrough was so keen to make sure the same thing didn't happen with Donald Trump. But obviously, Gore's claims for a legitimate recount were stronger than Donald Trump's.
So, Matthew, I think we need to talk about John Eastman. You were a witness in that case. Can we talk about that?
Sure. So that's right. I was the expert witness for the State Bar of California in John Eastman's disbarment proceeding earlier this year. And so the principal issue that I testified about is the powers, or to be more precise, the lack of powers that the vice president has in the electoral count. The 12th Amendment, which is what governs our electoral college, says that the president of the Senate, who is the vice president, shall open the certificates in the presence of the Senate and the House of Representatives, and then the votes shall be counted. And it says that in the passive voice. And as a result of that passive voice, it doesn't say exactly who does the counting. John Eastman and others, including Ken Chesbrough, advanced the theory that, well, actually, the vice president is the one who does the counting of electoral votes. And as a result of that, the vice president is the one who gets to resolve any disputes about electoral votes. So if there's, for example, multiple submissions of certificates from different slates of electors, Eastman advanced the theory that, well, it was actually Vice President Mike Pence who got to make the final decision about that. Now, the text doesn't fully resolve that issue one way or another. And so Eastman made a claim about history. He said that actually the original understanding of the Constitution going all the way back to the 1790s was that the vice president resolved disputes about this. And that was the basis of this fateful advice that he gave in a dramatic Oval Office meeting with President Trump and Vice President Mike Pence, where he was imploring Vice President Pence to exercise some unilateral constitutional authority to change the results of the election. Now, Vice President Pence ended up rejecting that theory, and he very dramatically, right before the electoral count started and the violence came to the Capitol, he released this public letter saying that he didn't believe that that was the right interpretation of the Constitution. And in this case, Vice President Mike Pence was right, and President Trump and his lawyers, Eastman and Chesbrough, were wrong. And so the way that Eastman ended up in a disbarment proceeding isn't just that he gave incorrect legal advice. It's that he gave legal advice that had no historical basis whatsoever. So Eastman based his theory on the idea that in 1797 and 1801, there were vice presidents, John Adams and then Thomas Jefferson, who presided over electoral counts in which they themselves were then elected president. And according to Eastman, those vice presidents, Adams and Jefferson, actually resolved disputes unilaterally about electoral votes, about the validity of electoral votes in 1797. It was about Vermont. in 1801, it was about Georgia. And according to Eastman, well, that's historical precedent. That shows that the way the founders imagined the Constitution and how this would work is that the vice president and not Congress would have the authority to resolve these sorts of disputes. Now, Eastman's history was flat out wrong. And so if you go back and read the records, it's absolutely clear that neither John Adams nor Thomas Jefferson resolved any disputes about this. You know, nobody ever suggested at the time that the vice president had this authority. And the way the process works from 1791 until today, Congress appoints these members of Congress as tellers, and the tellers do the counting. And this is still true. But John Eastman, you know, used this misunderstanding of history to say that Vice President Pence had this extraordinary power. And it's worth stepping back for a second to imagine how radical that view would be, not just because it defies history, but also because it would create a system where the vice president would get to decide whether he won re-election. You know, we sometimes gloss over the fact that John Eastman's advice to Mike Pence wasn't just that he could decide that President Trump would be re-elected as president. He was saying that Mike Pence could decide whether Mike Pence was reelected as vice president. And that violates a pretty fundamental principle of the rule of law that no man can be a judge in his own case. But that's exactly the theory that they advanced. And it's just completely unsupported by the history. And, you know, it's really difficult to imagine that Eastman, that Trump, would sit here today and say that Vice President Kamala Harris has the authority to decide the election on January 6th of 2025. And so I think that illustrates that perhaps they don't have the courage of their convictions.
So there is no there when it comes to Mike Pence changing the vote, huh?
That's absolutely right. There is no evidence at all. So there was no dispute about electoral votes that reached Congress during the electoral count in 1797 or 1801. And so there was no dispute to resolve. And after each of those electoral counts, exactly zero people said anything. And so according to Eastman's theory, John Adams and Thomas Jefferson each unilaterally decided that they would be elected president. And after that, nobody said anything. Nobody in the opposing political party complained at all. And that's like saying that, well, if Mike Pence counted Trump and Pence as reelected in 2021, that there would be absolutely nobody, not a newspaper column, not an opposing politician, not the losing candidate. Zero people would have complained about it. And that's just completely implausible. And when there actually were disputes about electoral votes, which happened about a half dozen times in the 19th century, the first time was in 1817, then 1821, 1837, 1857, and then 1877, which was the most serious one. In every single one of those cases, it is absolutely 100% clear that Congress resolved the dispute and the vice president played no role whatsoever.
What should be done to keep whoever wants to, though I assume it'll be Trump, from stealing this 2024 election?
The most important thing to address is the problem with electors, I think, because if the electors can be told to vote differently from how they were elected to vote, then that's an obvious, simple way for these rogue state legislatures to reverse the results. So it's pretty hard to imagine the Supreme Court addressing that question. I think one big thing to do is to begin to build out the understanding that this is possible and we've got to resolve that this just is not allowed to happen. So that would be my first vote. Matt, what's your second vote?
My second vote is that the residual ambiguities and weaknesses in the Electoral Count Reform Act. So Congress did an extraordinary thing, actually passed election reform, a reform of the Electoral Count Act. And so prior to the Electoral Count Reform Act, the old ECA, the one that we had in place on January 6th of 2021, was catastrophically vulnerable to manipulation. A single governor defining, you know, the outcome of the results in his or her state could potentially flip an election, and there was nothing that anybody could do about it. And so Congress did this extraordinary thing in December of 2022 that almost went unnoticed, given how significant it is, by closing a lot of those loopholes. But many loopholes remain. And so, you know, there's still time for Congress to step in. I'm not overly optimistic that that's going to happen. So I think that we need to be prepared for the possibility that these residual loopholes in the Electoral Count Reform Act can be exploited. And how do we organize against that? Well, I think there are two things. The first thing that we do is that we start preparing the legal arguments that we're going to have to make in court. The 2020 election didn't go to the Supreme Court, but, you know, as Larry indicated, you know, there's, I think, a serious risk that there are going to be legal issues that do end up becoming so severe and potentially outcome determinative, so it goes to the Supreme Court. So we need to be prepared to do that. But stepping back from that, there's something that we election lawyers call the margin of litigation. And so the reason why Bush v. Gore was such an intensely disputed election, where, you know, the election in New Mexico in 2020, where Biden had won by 10 points, wasn't, is because the difference was so big in New Mexico. And so we election lawyers talk about the margin of litigation as if it's not close enough that there are plausible or at least plausible sounding allegations of fraud or misconduct or illegality. If the margin is just really, really big, then these disputes and these legal questions don't have enough purchase to create real risks. The most important thing that people can do is vote and make it so that the margin is outside the margin of litigation. And now in our new world where election disputes go beyond courts and they go to state legislatures and they go to Congress and they go wherever they can possibly go, making sure that that margin is large enough that no state legislature would dare do the things that we are talking about. If, you know, Biden is declared the winner in, let's say, Georgia by 100 votes, then the state legislature may feel emboldened enough to say, oh, we think there were illegal votes, and so we're gonna direct the electors to vote for Trump instead of Biden. But if the margin is 50,000, then it's much less likely that there's going to be the political will, the political verve, the political shamelessness to take that step that would undermine the rule of law in our democracy.
Thank you both so much. I hope you guys will come back.
Every time you ask.
Thanks so much, Molly.
That's it for this episode of Fast Politics. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday to hear the best minds in politics make sense of all this chaos. If you enjoyed what you've heard, please send it to a friend and keep the conversation going. And again, thanks for listening.
Picasso knows your vacation home is your best home. It's the place that brings family and friends together. It's where you're the best version of yourself. Picasso makes it easy to co-own a luxury vacation home in amazing locations. Listings start at $200,000 for 1/8 ownership. Picasso does all the work for you. Luxury furnishings, maintenance, billing, scheduling, and more. And you can resell on Picasso's marketplace anytime, historically for a 10% gain. Visit Picasso to see thousands of listings. That's PACASO.com.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
When you have insurance, it's easy to forget about your out-of-pocket costs. That can be a lot of money. How do you know you're not overpaying? HealthLock can help. HealthLock is a technology company that securely connects with your insurance and reviews your claims for overbilling, wrong codes, and even fraud. To date, HealthLock has saved its members over $130 million. To save, visit HealthLock.com. Do it today before you see another healthcare provider.
As the number one audio company, iHeartMedia gives you access to all. Every audience, live conversations, trusted influencers, and the insights and data you need to grow. iHeartMedia is your access company. Go to iHeartResults.com for more.